Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
The spur for this series now, which is going to be on geopolitics, is an event that's occurring in January, which is the 120th anniversary of Sir Halford Mackinder's address to the Royal Geographical Society in London, which really is one of the seminal moments in geopolitical thought. And indeed, The Critic magazine has an article which is going to appear in the January issue. And in some respects, what we're doing now is offering, and over the next few issues, next few broadcasts, is offering a precursor to that issue, which reminds, I hope, listeners that it's worth, when they listen to The Critic's podcasts, to read the magazine, and when they read the monthly, to also listen to the podcasts. Now, Mackinder's talk is famous for discussing the conceptualization of, in effect, a global pivot or center of power, and locating that in a Eurasian heartland, more specifically in what we would now call Western Russia. And in doing so, he presented not a static account of world politics and power, but a dynamic one. He argued, essentially in response to the Russian building of the Trans-Siberian Railway to Vladivostok, the Russian naval base on the Pacific, he argued that there was a shift in world power and geopolitics from what he presented as the Columbian Age after Christopher Columbus, which he characterized as dominated by maritime power and associated in particular with Britain, and instead to the development of rail-borne land power. Incidentally, and Mackinder had not expected this, actually a member of the audience, later a distinguished Conservative cabinet minister, Leo Amery, who was famously Secretary of State for the colonies, piped up as a young man to warn about further transformation as he mentioned the new age of air. Remember, the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk had flown less than a year before. So in other words, what I want to try and do is to talk about geopolitics. Now, let me make it clear. In 2016, I published a lengthy book with Indiana University Press on geopolitics, but that went right back, as it were, to the beginning, and in particular, asked the question, which I've also discussed with reference to strategy, about the existence of geopolitics before the term. In this set of lectures for The Critic, which I believe people should listen to, and I hope they would find very helpful, what we're actually going to do is to focus on the period in which geopolitics existed as a formal term and a explicit conceptualization. It began as a formal term in the late 1890s, and essentially as a developed conceptualization, it's only been going for 120, 125 years. And the reason I want to look at that is to say that there are many echoes today that are worth considering in terms of previous examples, and in particular, the extent to which Britain was the great power in 1904, but its political, military, and economic primacy was then under serious challenge, and under challenge from more than one power, indeed from America, Russia, and Germany, all growing economies and expansionist states, and that there are precursors to the position for modern American commentators. I also, because we've got a lot to cover, because what we're doing is not just a story, we're trying, as The Critic always does, to, as it were, expand the way we can think and debate, I want to actually also look critically at the vocabulary and idea of geopolitics. And it's important to do so because most, not all, but most writers on geopolitics have used the term, the concept, and the idea, whether static or dynamic, in very unreflective and uncritical terms. In other words, they've assumed a ready existence of something we call geopolitics and have then essentially traced it through from, you know, Ratzel and Mackinder to the present, whatever the present is. And as you will know, if you've been reading commentary in modern publications, from journalism to articles and things like Foreign Policy, they absolutely ladle on the term geopolitics. Everything is geopolitical at the moment. You can see that in discussion of the Ukraine crisis, the Taiwan possible crisis, and everything else in between. And what I want to suggest is that this is not overly helpful if what we want to do is examining the question with rigidity and conceptual accuracy. If, on the other hand, we want a total flexibility in which geopolitics means anything you feel like, including where you put the rooms in a house, then by all means, use it in a lax fashion and be a journalist. But what we're actually saying is that advanced journalism, like scholarly commentary, demands and expects a higher standard, and that listeners and readers are entitled to that. So, if we turn to 2023, America, obviously, like Britain 100 years earlier, confronts a number of challenges, notably from China, but also from the very volatility of a global system in which American leadership was under great challenge, as more generally is the what you might call civilizational model of and from the West. Indeed, today, China deliberately sets out to contest American international models, seeing American global liberalism as a challenge to national sovereignty, with China presenting itself as offering the epitome, the model of the kind of the communist idea of what's called managed socialism. At the same time, American commentators and the American public are highly divided, and this will play out through the presidential election there, by the question of engagement with the outside world, as well as by the nature of prioritization in strategic areas and tasks. For example, contrary commitments to, as I've already mentioned, Taiwan, Ukraine, or the Middle East, or South Korea, or whatever. And this is a prioritization that can be presented as, in one respect, the reality of geopolitics, that it is a political debate, not a precise measure of some free-floating variable, which can, with astute intellectual rigor, be discerned and then used to produce an obvious consequence. Instead of which, the stress, and you will notice this repeatedly in this set of talks, is going to be on the politics of geo, as it were, the politics of the perception of geography, rather than presenting it as some apparently objective criteria. Now, there are clear parallels between past British and present American geopolitical issues. And I found an interesting example in 1883 from somebody whose name still decorates many British high streets, William Henry Smith, W.H. Smith, a conservative politician who had been First Lord of the Admiralty. And he told the House of Commons at this stage, he was a conservative, at this stage the Liberals under Gladstone were in power. He said, quote, "The duties to be discharged by the Navy, and which are of a very varying nature throughout the world, because heavier duties fall upon the Navy of this country than fall upon the navies of all other countries taken together. We have a large commerce, and practically we have to perform what are called the police duties of the seas, and we have in consequence to maintain an ironclad fleet equal to any emergency. In other words, the fundamental geopolitical expectation on the leading power in the system is that it actually has to be able to operate as a universal state. But as Smith explained to the House of Commons in the subsequent debate that year, this was difficult. At this moment, ironclads were, if you like, the aircraft carriers of the age. Ironclads have to be employed in the China and Australian seas, in the Pacific, on the coast of North America, and in the West Indies. Our fleet is scattered in a manner in which the fleet of no other power can be scattered. And while it is discharging duties in three or four different seas, if unfortunately we should be engaged in a war, foreign powers might be able to concentrate their forces against our navy. So Smith, at the outset, introduces us to something which links Britain then to America now, that the leading power in the system has particular geopolitical problems and responsibilities, that its potential challengers do not have these comparable problems, and that therefore there is no one measure of geopolitical tasking, geopolitical goals. It's not a question of you can measure off America against China, or earlier Britain against Germany, because each in those pairs, they each had very different requirements, and those very different geopolitics mean that you cannot assess the situation simply by counting military units. In this and other contexts, whether geopolitics demands a formal input of geographical theory or in knowledge, or indeed whatever can be discussed as geopolitical theory, are matters that we can debate. And I hope by the end of this set, we'll be debating them. In part, obviously, geopolitics is simply another aspect of the role of human geography. And human geography aids in the understanding and use of physical geography. In one sense, it's an intermediary, and it emphasizes the dynamic nature of the intermediary character of geography. So far from geography being destiny, as is so often said, human beings can alter geography. And indeed, shortly before Mackinder gave his lecture, this had been done with the construction of the Suez Canal. And a decade after he gave his lecture, that was to be followed up by the finishing of the Panama Canal. There is no one set of determinant features, in other words, that makes geopolitics a determinist characteristic, or indeed science. Now, the subject of geopolitics, and this is going to sound a bit dull, but hear me out, has been extended considerably in recent analysis, not only to include a trilogy of geopolitical constructs, subjects, and what are known as landscapes. So a geopolitical landscape might be, for example, the eastern states of NATO, recently anchored in NATO, all operating in terms of an interaction of agents and structures. So again, if you're looking at the present situation, NATO would be a structural component of geopolitics, but the agents involved would include the particular political parties that might decide how they are going to approach the tasks that may seem apparent from that structure. And this factor is not deterministic, but also there's only so far that it's atomistic or diffuse. There's only so far that you can take it. In other words, I mean, there is an East, you know, it's not just a matter of perception. There is an Eastern tranche of NATO, and it does come up against the Russian sphere of power. It doesn't come up against, shall we say, the Iranian sphere of power. In other words, at that very loose state, geography does exist. Geopolitics is also a variant on the geography of strategy, as strategy seeks more explicitly to engage, persuade, and instruct the public. And indeed, that's one way of looking at what I was saying earlier, that commentators today, with a sort of verbal diarrhea, spread the term geopolitics all over the landscape. But another way to look at that is that if you read somebody who is deploying the language of geopolitics, what they are tending to say is, I have an answer and my answer should be followed because the geography of the situation dictates it. Well, as I'm going to be showing, dictation in this case is not very helpful. But if what you're arguing is a politics of engagement, then that's absolutely fine. And as we know, we've already on the Critic website covered strategy. And as we know, a lack of agreement over definitions is shared for other terms such as strategy or realpolitik. So allowing for this fundamental flaw, theory creates plentiful opportunities for commentators, and noticeably so, as it rests on vague definitions and propositions. So, with geopolitics having many meanings, it overlaps with what used to be called, particularly in the United States, grand strategy. And that, again, was a term that was useful because it was imprecise. To take that further, geoculture can also play a role, with the work in particular of Samuel Huntington in the 1990s, work that was very much taken forward in the 2000s, with the idea of the clash of cultures being the dominant geographical factor in world politics, an idea which was then inscribed on a supposed sort of rivalry between Islam and the West, when in practice there were some elements of Islam that were very antipathetical, but there were others that were not. So theory provides, as always, an attempt to offer an alternative to the ad hoc nature of developments. Indeed, geopolitical arguments provide a way to explain and justify specific policies. Yet at the same time, geopolitical arguments in doing so frequently fail to differentiate adequately between short, medium, and long-term requirements, needs, threats, and opportunities, and also between positive and negative goals and capabilities. If by next week you've found 10 uses of geopolitics in your newspaper, you will notice that they don't share the same definition, the same usage. And the subject-object relation is frequently unclear. Geopolitics is both the subject, which influences the actors, and the object, which is affected by events and actors. And each of those then plays an interplay. Thus, in practice, geopolitics is a feedback loop, which is very malleable, easy to remold. Now, what I want to do is to not just talk about ideas. I want to engage, as it were, with looking at how this changes through time. But let me just give you an example of the sort of looseness that one can often see. So take, for example, the Centre for Geopolitics at the University of Cambridge. I noticed its annual report of 2020 declared its mission in the following terms. I mean, obviously, it was seeking grubbing for money, but, you know, it's still interesting to see how they grub for money. It said the following, that it was out to provide historically grounded solutions to enduring geopolitical problems. But if you then read the report, there is no analysis of what geopolitics actually meant, nor indeed any sign that there is an understanding of geography in that center beyond using terms such as China or the Middle East or Britain's place in the world. In other words, geography for that center was and is location, not context, nor indeed dynamic in such accounts. Now, such facile usages of geopolitics are very, very commonplace. So with that as the background, let's try and you know, we can take some of these conceptual ideas on. Let's try and go to understand where Mackinder was coming from, and let's try and understand what was the nature of geopolitics as it was understood by British commentators at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. I think that would be a good place to pause, Graham, and have a discussion of what we've covered so far.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Black. I think I want to start by getting your sense of where geopolitics was before the term was in currency. So many of the component parts of geopolitics were, of course, in active use: foreign policy, diplomacy, the ability to understand maps and logistics, the ability to know where military forces were. What was different at the end of the 19th century in terms of an ability for strategists to perceive where foreign policy's national interests lay, as distinct from after there was a more considered, a more cohesive study of geopolitics itself? What was missing from the 19th century understanding?
Oh, I think that's a fascinating question. I mean, let's start off by saying the 19th century, particularly towards the end, is becoming extraordinarily volatile because it's the age of increasingly competitive imperialism. If you look at, for example, the 1820s, 30s and 40s, there was a sense that there was plenty of space for Britain, France, Russia. They were expanding, but they weren't necessarily rubbing up against each other. That situation is very different by the 1880s or even more 1890s. So 1898 in the Fashoda crisis, Britain and France nearly goes to war. France's ally, of course, is Russia at that point. You know, the British are having to think about a major naval conflict of potentially global scale. In 1885, in the Peshmerga crisis, they'd had the same anxieties about Russia as well. So I think, first of all, you've got imperialism providing a dynamic practice of competition. Second of all, I think you've got the diffusion of what we might call Darwinian ideas, and we might use the concept social Darwinianism, though if we do, we need to remember that that meant different things to different people. But this idea that there was an inherent competitiveness, that you couldn't stand still, that to stand still was to be demolished and devoured, was one that was very potent in late 19th century thought. And there is also, I'm not a technological determinist, but technology was speeding this sense of the potential of change. Whether the technology was communications, particularly the communications of information around global systems, telegram, of course, being a key one, and you're obviously just about to reach radio, or whether, of course, it's, as I've already mentioned earlier, transcontinental railways, of which the first transcontinental railway was that across the United States. So what I think one has got is this real sense that, as it were, just standing still wasn't going to do anything. That we had to, we being whichever was the society you were in, had to understand the world and react rapidly And in that understanding, you've also got the sort of rise of what we in our context would call for recent decades, the isms. Well, they didn't quite use that term for that period. But one of the impacts of the idea of the prestige of science, or at the very least formulated thought, was to encourage conceptualization that is defined. And you've got new agencies to do so. You've got general staffs for the military, which are fundamentally a late 19th century innovation. You've got the rise of the, as it were, utilitarian university. I don't mean utilitarian in the shape of the academics pouring port down their gullets whilst they're pretending to teach the sons of the aristocracy. I mean the kind of German research university method, which was then taken up by the University of Chicago, et cetera, and of which the British equivalents were Manchester and London. So, and it's no accident that Mackinder is giving his talk to a, as it were, British body that supposedly bring, and it did, brings together recent knowledge, intellectual ideas, and men of business, the Royal Geographical Society, and that it is in London, not in Oxford or Cambridge. There's no accident about that. The idea that knowledge, in order to work, has to be waged as in a competitive fashion, and that to doing in doing so you need the new ideas and they need to be effective. You know, I think that that is an important one. The politicians of that period considered themselves men of business. So I mean, to give you an example, take 1877. Robert III, Marquess of Salisbury, who later, of course, is Prime Minister, and a long-standing Conservative Prime Minister, is Secretary of State for India in 1877. And at the time of a crisis about competition with Russia, and indeed, you know, jingoism is the term that's to be launched in this 1877 to 1878 crisis, Salisbury declares the following in Parliament. "I cannot help thinking that in discussions of this kind, a great deal of misapprehension arises from the popular use of maps on a small scale. As with such maps, you were able to put a thumb on India and a finger on Russia, some persons at once think that the political situation is alarming and that India must be looked to. If the noble lord would use a larger map, say one on the scale of the Ordnance map of England, he would find that the distance between Russia and British India is not to be measured by the finger and thumb, but by the rule. The rule is the ruler, and no such map was, of course, available. But what Salisbury is saying is, get it right. Try and use knowledge to understand geography. And, you know, it's possible to, as it were, as I was doing earlier, criticize some, indeed often much, of the usage of geography, but any usage is better than the overwhelming habit among commentators and the public, which you still see to today, and shooting off with no knowledge at all. I mean, there's a fascinating sort of very mediocre series of books on the prisoners of geography. It's called Books Like That, in which if you look at the maps, you'll note it all, it proclaims the significance of geography. Well, if you look at the maps and you look at the book, you notice sort of he seems to be rather innocent of thinking about fundamental factors like topography and terrain. So in other words, yes, if you're going to use geography, I would argue you should try and get it right. And that, in a sense, is what Mackinder is trying to do. Mackinder is committed, and we will be discussing this, you know, but Mackinder, crucially, is not just committed to geography. He is committed to public education and to the utilitarian exposition by and for government of knowledge in order to shape politics and policy. And that is what he understands geopolitics to be.
And of that generation, really at the end of the 19th century, before we're getting into those who were then influenced by Mackinder in turn in the 20th, at the end of the 19th century, how many of those thinkers, individuals who were shaping this way of looking at what we now call geopolitics, how many of them were directly employed in government departments?
Well, that's again a very interesting question. Mackinder is trying, as you may know, the best book on him is by a chap called, a friend of mine actually, called Brian Bluet, very good biography. Mackinder tries to shape a generation of bureaucrats because the bureaucracy is changing. It's expanding quite considerably. But the core elements who really understand or are interested in geography come from different interests. There is the Admiralty. There is the India interest. And I think Salisbury is making this point in 1877. There is an assumption that politicians who are active in government or in opposition, and Smith, we were making the point earlier, they're not people who in that period tend to be focused on, you know, the state of the hospitals or the education, because most of these kind of issues are handled by local government or by non-governmental bodies. There is a much higher expectation that ministers and influential politicians will be interested in strategic and what we might call geopolitical interests. So from that point of view, you could say there are several thousand people who would be strongly interested if in that several thousand you include leading and ambitious city figures, and the corollary is elsewhere in places like Manchester, who are very actively concerned about the global interests of Britain. Britain, remember, although its industry is falling behind that of the of Germany and still more the United States, nevertheless remains the greatest trading power in the world and the state with the most foreign investment. And for those to occur, you do really need some sense of geopolitics.
I was very interested in what you said about a growing awareness in the late 19th century that it wasn't possible to stand still anymore. You know, there's no kind of eternal foreign policy. Economies, societies were moving on, innovating very rapidly. Should we see this as merely the fruits of industrialization and technological advance being recognized and the shift in power that they brought? Should we see this as something primarily attached to a growing fear about Germany? Or do many of these ideas actually come from Germany?
Oh, well, Germany is an important source. I mean, the actual person who really launches geopolitics is a phrase was a Swede who does so in 1899, but he, and incidentally was a very political figure, was influenced by a German, Friedrich Ratzel, and Ratzel had stressed the close relationship of people and environment in a kind of vitalist fashion within a competitive international system in a number of books, notably, I'm just translating from the German here, obviously, his Political Geography of 1897. And he was to be influential. I mean, most people have never heard of Ratzel, but they've heard of one of his concepts he liked to push, which was that of Lebensraum or living space. So Ratzel is an important figure in developing what you might call the idea of the state as a product of racial construction, one that's given identity by organic factors, a biological account of community, not by constitutional development, which is a kind of mechanistic account, you know, balance of power sort of thing within a state, which is the Anglo-American notion. So what's interesting is that geopolitics inscribes into its rhetoric and theory, if theory isn't too grand a term, very different accounts of the nature of statecraft. And indeed, you know, there is a fair, and we're going to be talking about this in these talks, and I hope it's going to be very interesting for listeners accordingly. There is a sort of link between Ratzel and the development of German geopolitics that culminates with the Third Reich, and in the contrary sense, the Anglo-American tradition. And I think, therefore, that one of the points that to bring out is that contrasting ideas of geopolitics are actually very, very significant in world affairs. And we're then going to be taking that forward to the present day and looking at the contrasting idea of Putin, who in many senses is in the Germanic tradition, and that of a more democratic liberal concept, which is very much the Western idea.
Well, these contrasting ideas will be taking forward in the next editions of this podcast series. But for outlining the nature and the start, the birth of geopolitics as something that is distinct, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Now, listeners may just simply want to listen. They don't need to do anything else. But if those want to take it a stage further, Mackinder's lecture and, in fact, the subsequent discussion there is available online for free and is worth looking at. The 1904, it's January the 25th, the discussion at the Royal Geographical Society. And I mean, I'm not saying buy it, get it out of a library, but my book, Geopolitics and the Quest for Dominance, will give you a background. So the whole point of these talks is to go beyond that.
Well, that's a very helpful pointer. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.